to another Yes to Life show, in which, as always, I'll be looking into cancer and integrative medicine for cancer. For this week's show, I travel to Exeter in the West Country to meet Dr. Rajendra Sharma. For practitioners listening, I hope you'll be inspired to hear that Dr. Sharma has recently become a gold supporter of Yes to Life and is thereby consistently supporting the charity and helping people with cancer. If you'd like to find out more about how you could support the charity, whether you're a practitioner or not, then please do get in touch. Full details are on our website, yestolife.org.uk. Yeah, good afternoon, Rajendra. Nice to see you again. Thanks for inviting me to your home, and great to catch up on what you're doing now.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you here. I do hope I can contribute.
All right. So in your patient information, whilst you're encouraging people to consult their oncologist, you make it quite clear you feel there are quite a few shortcomings in conventional care, and the statistics kind of show little progress in success rates. So you naturally feel that an integrative approach has much to offer to improve this situation. So firstly, in very broad terms, what do you think are the real strengths of integrative medicine for cancer?
The strengths lie, I think, in constantly concentrating on the fact that the body battles cancer every moment of every day. And whilst conventional medicine has made strides and has some fantastic treatments in so many areas, it is dependent upon an external factor to attack the cancer. Mm-hmm. And conventional medicine doesn't focus, I think, at all, unfortunately, on the potential benefits that the body itself has.
Just beginning, isn't it? Some of the new immunotherapy type treatments are just beginning.
Just this week we've had the announcement, although that particular work has been going on for several years, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
But the evidence that of its efficacy has been limited. Hmm. This week, indeed, we've now found that if we use drugs to promote the immune system, they will specifically attack specific blood-borne cancers. Hmm. Whether that will expand into its benefits on hard tumours, we don't know, and we have to accept, like any drug, it seems to have a lot of side effects.
As always.
But the body, of course, is constantly fighting solid tumours or a rogue cell that could become a solid tumour. Mm. And if we've got our T cells working well, and particularly the subgroup of T cells called natural killer cells, the NK cells, then, of course, we're confident that we're not going to go down with tumours, whilst we are confident that our immune system is working well. Mm. So I think where the strengths lie in an integrated approach is the addition to a conventional therapy that has got benefit, as opposed to a conventional therapy that may not have benefit, and that's a whole subject that we may touch upon in any case, is to try and keep the immune system boosted as best it can. We also find that in conventional medicine, the attack is entirely on the cancer and not upon the cause.
Right.
So research into causation is limited. If you have a lung cancer and it's a smoking-related one, well, then that's fair enough. You stop smoking. And we learn more or less weekly, don't we, about an intake that we have, whether it's intentional through a food or it's unintentional through an environmental chemical. That is a potential cause of cancer. Yeah. So eating too much meat, if you have the wrong genes, can increase your colon cancer risk. But that doesn't make meat bad. It means that you as an individual can't deal with it very well. So if we spent a little bit more time on understanding the causation and a little less time on being retroactive on attacking a cancer once it's set in, I think there would be another great way of strengthening the charge against cancer. Mm. You said that my information sheets talk about the shortcomings. Well, that's not strictly true. I'm actually very supportive of conventional medicine in its right place.
Limitations.
It's limitations. Right. Yeah, spot on.
Okay, so you divide potential strategies that you're involved with into two categories, supportive and proactive. So it's an interesting distinction. And maybe you could elaborate on the differences and give examples of each of those.
Of course, thank you. If one's being supportive, I look upon that as what perhaps we would call complementary medicine.
Okay.
So you're going through the best option that conventional medicine can offer, and we will do everything we can to support you through that process. Now, without wishing to be emotive, we can talk about cut, burning and poisoning. And the point being that we often go into the cutting, the surgery, having not been well leading up to the surgery, mm-hmm. going in a day before the surgery and going on a nil by mouth diet. We come out of surgery often into a very poor nutritional diet for as long as it takes for us to recover from surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of bowel surgery, you may go several days without eating substantially or properly or nutritionally. Now, anybody who's going to go into battle would stock themselves up beforehand. And we don't do that. And I've never quite understood that. So I think it's extremely important for people who go through the surgical part of conventional treatment to spend a little bit of time beforehand building themselves up. We know from very clear scientific evidence of the benefits in healing of the amino acid arginine, zinc, vitamin C, the B complexes, all very relevant to the process of healing. Vitamin D, a hugely important vitamin in basic skin and injury healing. But we, by the time we get to March in the UK, about 75% have sub deficiency in vitamin D. Right. And if we take in the Indian population and the African or blacker skin, the darker skin, even mine as a half Indian, half English person, put me in the sunshine for a short while and I tan up.
Mm.
Now, I definitely have to take vitamin D through the winter to make sure that I'm not deficient by March. So we go into surgery potentially vitamin D deficient, and that's not going to help the healing aspect.
Mm.
We also have to go through an anaesthetic, and yeah. an anaesthetic is very much like my taking you out and drinking a bottle of vodka with you through an evening. You
okay.
know, it's going to hit the nervous system to a point that it knocks us out.
Mm-hmm.
So the nervous system has to recover from that. And although we don't have the dehydration hangover effect, perhaps from an anaesthetic, for in quite the same way that we might do the morning after the night before, we are still not doing much in the way of boosting the nervous system before it gets hit very hard. So pre- and post-operative care, I think, falls into the supportive aspect.
Mm.
Then we come on to radiotherapy. Radiotherapy is a damaging ionizing radiation. And yet, there are quite a few studies out there that indicate how to protect healthy cells from radiation. We know that people who live in higher altitudes have, amongst the plant population, high antioxidant foods. And we know that they don't struggle at the rate that we would if we come from a low altitude to a higher altitude with things like skin cancers. And yet they're exposed to greater levels of radiation. So just from that observation, and then going through and looking at the information on correct dosage antioxidants and other compounds, vitamin K can be quite protective of radiated cells if they're healthy, but they actually enhance the damage to cancer cells. So I have a pre-radiation protocol. And then depending on how the person has done as they've gone through it. Now what you can't have is just launch yourself into some amateur self-treatment, because part of radiation therapy is to promote free radical activity. And if you're piling in very high doses of antioxidants, you can negate some of the effect. So if you're going to follow the conventional, you've got to give the conventional its fullest boost.
Yeah. And most maybe you could just go into that in a little bit more detail about the free radical activity and everything, just to explain the mechanism there.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
When we irradiate a cell, we are in part creating a damage to both the cell nuclear DNA and also the potentially faulty mitochondrial DNA, which we'll come on to in a little while when we discuss potential therapies. And the damage can affect a cancer cell more so than it will affect a normal cell. We can protect against DNA damage by using certain particular antioxidants. Zinc, manganese, and intracellular magnesium are all very important to the protection of cells. So radiologists are concerned that people taking too high a dose will take in antioxidants which neutralize free radicals.
Right.
Because the second part of radiation therapy is the production of free radicals. So these positively charged particles that cause damage can be neutralized by antioxidants, and you end up negating some of the radiation effect. Mm. But nevertheless, giving a reasonable amount of antioxidants, which is actually above that that we normally take in. And that's the point. You don't find radiologists saying to their patients, radiotherapists, saying to their patients, I don't want you to have fruit, and I don't want you to have salads,
right,
and I don't want you to have healthy vegetable meals.
Yeah.
It's just not a consideration in conventional medicine.
No.
So what you mustn't do is take too much, but what you must do is get up to that level that the body would consider optimum.
Right.
Now, we talk about these 5 portions of fruit and vegetable a day, but most science actually suggests that we need 9 or 10 portions a day. So most of us, even if we are trying to do our best on national guidelines or international guidelines, are still not taking in enough in the way of antioxidant nutrients most of the time. And unfortunately, we could probably put a lot of aging diseases and aging processes down to long-term deficiencies in particular vitamins and minerals, and most of those are antioxidant.
Right.
The third aspect is chemotherapy.
Yes.
And when you take chemotherapy, you are effectively trying to attack fast replicating cells, and the drugs are aimed at those that have particular tendencies which include this fast replication. But unfortunately, we've got a lot of cells in our body that are fast replicators. Our hair follicles are fast. Our bowel wall turnover is very rapid. Within a few days, none of the surface cells in the epithelium and the inner lining of the gut are going to be the same that you had a week ago. Bone marrow is a fast replicating cell. So what happens with chemotherapy is that as sadly many people are aware, you drop your white blood cell count, you drop your red blood cell count, you can lose your hair, you can get all sorts of tummy upsets. The drugs then have to go through the liver and the kidneys, and the liver does its very best to break down the toxins. But unfortunately, some of the breakdown products of the toxins are actually more harmful than the toxin.
Yeah.
So for that, we have phase one in the liver, phase one detoxification, which breaks down the toxins, and phase two, which binds the toxins. So the altered toxin, which may now be more toxic, gets bound, and you've got phase one, phase two activity in the liver. But that's meant to be dealing with your daily basic toxins as well. But if they are being diverted to this very powerful, or these very powerful drugs that go into a chemotherapy course, why are we not paying some attention to the liver? So can we help the liver become more active? Can we rest it through sensible dieting and lifestyle before we go on to chemo? Can we then take nutrients through chemotherapy that speed up phase one, phase two? Because that won't alter to any great degree the effect of the drug.
No.
Many of the pulse courses in chemotherapy are, of course, given on a day, or and you're kept in hospital overnight, and then you're told to come back in 2 or 3 weeks when you've recovered from that level of poisoning. So those drugs are only going to be active for 72 hours or so, at their maximum. They're going to, of course, still be active to a degree. But speeding up the liver detoxification process for the byproducts seems to be a sensible idea. Now, we need to stress here, I'm not an oncologist, and perhaps if an oncologist is listening, he or she may criticise that statement. because we want the drugs in for as long as possible. Possibly, but the same oncologist will also point out how many people succumb to the chemotherapy or don't handle the chemotherapy, so they can't complete their course. Mm-hmm. When you look at the papers, as I've done, in nutritional studies particularly, and then to a degree botanical studies, and I'm not a medical herbalist, so I would leave that to associates and colleagues of mine if I needed to. But there's an awful lot of information on what natural products can be used to boost the liver. Mm. There's a lot of evidence of what can be used to protect the gut wall. And again, the nervous system gets hit by chemotherapy. People get tingling and sometimes very persistent numbness and dysfunction.
In their fingers and toes, particularly.
So what? And yet there is evidence out there that simple expedients like B complexes, like N-acetylcysteine, NAC, can be very protective of nerves. Mm. So my belief is that you have to have a good look at an individual's lifestyle, their dietetics, build them up where you think that the deficiencies may lie, take them through chemotherapy with adjuvant supportive natural therapies. Again, don't wallop in high dose antioxidants, because a lot of chemotherapy may have its benefits through the production of free radicals at the site of the cancer cell, although most don't work that way.
Right.
And in America, we're beginning to see research institutes, particularly the Kansas University Oncology Center, where they're administering vitamin C pretty much alongside chemotherapy.
Yes, very high doses as well.
Intravenous, very high doses. And they, of course, have a close association with the Oregon-based Linus Pauling Institute, which is probably why they are the ones putting up on their website and to a degree publishing. I wouldn't say that they're pouring out a lot of information, unfortunately. But clearly their oncologists have done their homework and they seem to be quite happy to administer this. Well, we've yet to find an oncologist in this country that is happy to wallop out vitamin C infusions at the same time. Mm. So it's about balancing and making sure that the best and optimum treatment is available from a conventional point of view, putting in the supportive and adjuvant treatments through surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and doing our best to not assume that chemotherapy is the be-all and end-all, nor assume that it doesn't have an absolute place. Conventional medicine have an absolute place in treatment, but we mustn't be giving things that might block the problem. We can always use high-dose vitamin C as an example to restore certain levels of function. And there's studies out there that I don't think can be totally disrespected about quality of life and longevity. Mm. And I'm certainly not making a statement that vitamin C therapy is cancer curative. We still don't have the science behind that. But we do seem to be having quite a bit of evidence that it may well turn out to be a cancer therapy, and that it may well be very supportive of people who go through conventional treatments.
Okay, so that's covered the supportive side very well. Great. So what about the proactive then?
The proactive is, to a degree, the supportive always.
Right.
And then having a look at the evidence that is coming forward on potential cancer therapy. And again, I have to put in the disclaimer. I'm not an oncologist. I do not go around proclaiming, and nor do any of my colleagues who look at the integrated side. Or let's say it's the complementary medical side. We're not going around making claims of cure by any means. But what we are seeing is that there is more and more information coming forward, either through laboratory studies, animal studies, and small human studies. And that there lies one of our biggest problems, as you know better than I. It's trying to get a larger human study done that can provide incontrovertible evidence about natural therapies, because we are caught up in the medico-legal aspect of all of this, and you can't take 100 people with a particular type of cancer and say, tell you what, we're only going to treat you with a natural therapy, because the ethics committee won't do that, even if you've got a difficult cancer to treat. You've got to therefore base it on people who choose not to go through conventional.
Yes.
And that leaves the numbers of cases that come through small you most studies have to take into account that if you're using a natural therapy, you have already and also done conventional therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone in my field is going to have that case where they, the patient themselves, is convinced that it's the natural therapy that did it, that made the difference.
Mm.
But the conventional physicians would look at it and say, well, you say that's what did it, but you had been through a chemotherapy course.
Mm.
And even if there wasn't an immediate benefit from the chemotherapy, it might have been that created the benefit later on. It's a spurious argument.
It's a very hard one to meet. One of the great soft spots in a way that people sometimes hit with unconventional approaches and trials is to go for a situation where there's actually nothing on offer from conventional medicine. It seems to be a great place to go. Either there's nothing on offer, or what is on offer is so hopeless, the statistics are so bad, that if you can show anything that's even as good, or certainly if you can show something that's better, then you've really got something to shout about. It seems a good way to go, in a way, for if you want to trial something unconventional, well, just try the people who are not going to get much help elsewhere.
Yes, indeed. So, I couldn't agree with that more. And in the proactive environment, as I call it, where we are looking at trying to help somebody who has a problem and they choose not to, or they can't find a good conventional therapy, then the proactive becomes even more important. Because you can sit back and do nothing, or you can, of course, try and grab the bull by the horns and bring in as much as you can from a natural point of view. It's a huge subject, and we'd be sitting here all day if we were going to go through it all, but it's extremely important, really, to start from the top down, because the work on your psycho-spiritual well-being is remarkably important. And there are, as you know, many a study that show those that have take a very positive approach, have a positive mental attitude to outcome, do better than those who in some way give up or feel hopeless and uninvolved. And again, conventional medicine does rather take away that potential benefit that it seems to be, in my mind, from the papers I've read, so clear. The simple expedience of meditation, yoga exercises, and exercise is a big one, we'll touch upon that in a second perhaps, but having that mental calmness, and then bringing into play the breathing aspect. And the breathing aspect, correcting the breathing, automatically oxygenates the system.
Right.
And if you oxygenate the system, you walk into the evidence there is on oxygen therapies, and the potential benefits of hyperbaric oxygen, and perhaps, not that we can offer that easily in this country, ozone therapy, where integrated centres in Germany run by integrated oncologists, these are oncologists with a natural bent, most offer ozone as part of their therapy, along with, say, hyperthermia. And now we're looking at studies coming out of Japan in particular, where they're using far infrared therapy to enable patients to have a daily or several times a day hyperthermic treatment, a high temperature treatment. Before you'd have to go off to a sauna. You can't just lie in a hot bath, unfortunately. The body's too good at controlling its inner core. But you'd go into a sauna and that, the body can't always control it that way. But accessing a sauna, perhaps you can go somewhere once or twice a week, but going regularly is difficult. So I'm in the proactive section, very keen on looking at hyperthermia as a far infrared hyperthermia as an option, and then of course making sure that the equipment that you get is effective and beneficial, and making sure that you're advised on how best to use it.
So you're talking about home equipment there.
Yes,
you can use it every day at home.
Home equipment.
Yeah, because hypothermia can be a very specialised treatment at a clinic as well.
Indeed.
Local hypothermia, full body hypothermia. These are, the setup's very expensive, and you go then pay for the treatment.
You do, and I'm not sure that it happens outside of research centres here in the UK, And if you go abroad, of course, you're into the thousands.
Yeah.
And but the advantage of hypothermia in a centre is that you can reduce the chemotherapy dosage.
Yes.
In many cases.
That's what integrative medicine really means, is when you actually make the two work together. Indeed. Synergistically.
Indeed. Yeah. And again, in the proactive, just talking about hypothermia, is many of the many cancer cells are not sensitive to heat, and others are. And we can now measure whether or not a cancer cell, an individual's particular cancer cell or cancer tumour, is heat sensitive. And this is by measuring something called heat shock protein.
Okay.
All cells in the body have heat shock proteins. And you can liken these little proteins as heat absorbers to boiling a pan up before you put your eggs in to have boiled eggs on a Sunday. And you put the eggs in and the bubbling hot boiling water just slows down and cools down, doesn't bubble for a moment, and then it builds back up again because the egg absorbs the heat from the surrounding water. Heat shock proteins found in all the cells in our body, most of the cells in our body, are capable of absorbing heat, which allows you and I to wander across the Sahara Desert for 5-6 hours before we would succumb.
Right.
Because our body temperature will rise, but the heat shock proteins protect us. Without going into the science, biochemistry of the cell is dependent upon us being at 98.4 and 36, 37 degrees centigrade. Outside of that, our biochemistry starts to go wrong. So being persistently at 40 degrees will eventually kill us.
Right.
If we go up to 42, we will die very quickly. And this isn't because we get too hot, it's because the actual biochemistry of the cell breaks down.
Yeah.
So being able to do tests of that sort is very relevant. And part of the proactive concept is to look at what there is available for investigation through blood and tumour testing.
Yeah.
Whether we go on to that straight away or we...
It's my next question. I was going to ask you about specific tests. So anyway, do you feel you've covered the proactive side there? You said, yeah.
Well, yes. Of course, what I haven't said, I think I was saying a bit earlier, is the proactive, of course, brings into play other therapies. And if we look at things like the research on curcumin, turmeric extract, resveratrol, salvestrol, artemisia, vitamin C, we've talked about, vitamin D. These are all ones that if you actually tap into the web, cancer natural treatments, these will all come up fairly quickly on the browser. And you're looking at this, and you're looking at page one of a million different sites, and you're wondering, well, what can we do? And then, of course, you've got sites like yours. Fantastic. Yes, life. So you can go on there and you can read through, well, here's a study of this in colon cancer and this in renal cancer. And that expansion of information is becoming enormous. We've got your book coming out in April.
And, yes.
There you've got UK and world experts talking about their experiences. And all of us to date have had to rely on your experts and world experts saying, well, I've done this on hundreds of cases, thousands of cases, and here are the outcomes. And of course, the publication of these has to be limited.
Yes.
Because if you do treat somebody with a vitamin C therapy or with artemisia or with curcumin as an integrated physician, the patient has probably been through or is going through some form of conventional therapy. So you can't do audit and publish papers in the same way that the conventional world would like you to do. But then, of course, we have problems with conventional investigations and research anyway, don't we? Because I've been writing a paper for an Oxford journal, and I was very surprised to find that 150 drugs that have been put through all the optimum processes to be allowed onto the market have then, and these 150 plus, have remained on the market treating people despite their immense dangers and causing, in some cases, thousands of deaths.
Yeah.
And yet, they've gone through...
It's a mess.
...that which we consider that we, in the natural world, have to match up to.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done this for 30 years. I've never killed anyone with vitamin.
Right. So it's shocking. But the only good news is that the fact that things are this bad is becoming more and more apparent to the public. I see that 2 days running, the Daily Telegraph has put out sort of shock, horror, we found out that the people who are actually making all the decisions are in the pay of the pharmaceuticals, you know. And I say there's two separate articles pointing the finger at two different areas, and the health department of health has actually responded to the first one already. So, you know, it's beginning to become public knowledge that actually it's extremely corrupt.
Fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah,
fantastic.
It's about time. I mean, you know, this shock horror revelations, actually, it's always been like that. But now we know, you know, few more people are beginning to know.
And I don't think it's a hidden factor that the Federal Drugs Administration in America, the FDA, highly financed by the pharmaceutical industry, and nearly every medical journal around the world is dependent upon pharmaceutical money.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we can take that a bit further, because a lot of research that goes on in universities, of course, is funded by pharmaceutical companies, who, if they see something on the list that that particular biochemical department or biology department might be researching, like, say, a natural cancer therapy, they will withdraw their interest, leaving the university in a place where we can't do that, because then we won't be able to fund our next year. But putting aside the controversies and the conspiratorial aspect, the last aspect, I think, of the proactive section is this the methods that we now have to actually investigate individuals and how they are going into therapy, or how we can help them choose alternative therapy. So a proactive approach of having a look at the amount of chemicals in the system, the ability to detoxify, the activity of the liver in itself, making sure that we are nutritionally sound, and measuring our antioxidant activity, is all really basic stuff that would be offerable by anyone from a naturopath upwards. Going into the harder science, we can start looking at how are the white blood cells working, how are the T cells working, how are the natural killer cells working. If they are all sub-functional, there is, until recently, no real evidence that drugs would help that. But there is plenty of evidence that naturopathic therapy will.
Right.
We can look at what is stuck to cell membranes. We can look at what is stuck to DNA. So in smokers, we find cadmium locked into the DNA, one of the mechanisms by which cigarettes create cancer. 9 out of 10 people who smoke don't get cancer. So the argument that the tobacco industry have put up for so many years, you know, look, there's an association, but it's not a cause. Well, it has some grounding. The fact is that some people, perhaps most people, are quite good at eliminating the toxins. But if you happen to fall into that category of 10, 15% of people who don't eliminate well, then the cigarette to you is so much more harmful.
Right.
As could be, say, barbecued foods, which are carcinogenic, and the nitrates found in smoked foods and preserved foods. So we can now measure that, because we can do genomic testing to see whether you are genetically predetermined to not deal with toxins well. Well, it would be a great help, wouldn't it, if you as a parent know that your child, because you've done a basic genomic test, is not a good detoxifier of these particular chemicals. You've got an opportunity to educate your child from a very young age. And I think if as a teenager you are told, you don't have the genes, you can't do it, you're going to be far less likely to say, well, I'll be one of the lucky ones I'll have a cigarette and see what
this
happens.
This is kind of the positive side of looking at these things, because in a way it gets portrayed of like, you know, if you look and you find the bad genes, well, that's it, you've had it, you know. Yeah. It's a very negative thing. It's a victim of my genes, you know. Yes. Is the way it sort of gets portrayed. But of course, when you have a lot of natural resources for actually influencing what happens, then it's a completely different picture. It gives you a proactive situation. You can make darn sure you're going to avoid some horrible
Absolutely
situation.
Right. Genes get switched on and get switched off. And they are turned on and off by the most basic of things, like folic acid, vitamin B12, and botanicals. things like ginkgo actually work at a DNA level. They have other functions, but they actually penetrate the cell and turn on and turn off particular parts of the gene. So eating well, keeping your stress levels down, because the adrenaline-like catecholamines, they're called the stress hormones, are known to switch on and switch off DNA. They also influence the cell membrane, and the cell membrane will allow good things in, but too much of the wrong stress hormone, those good things don't go in, and bad things go in place. So genomics is a very proactive method, even if you're struggling with the battle against cancer, because to know where you are at allows you to potentially change how your body will behave after your treatment. And that has to potentially, I mean, logically, reduce your chance of recurrence. The most exciting test, I think, that's coming forward is put out by the Research Genetic Cancer Centre, which is a small laboratory in Florina, in middle northern Greece. Not Oxford, not Cambridge. But what they are doing is they are using a worldwide respected technique for capturing cancer cells from the bloodstream. It is universally accepted that a tumour outside of the brain, brain tumours are somewhat different, but a body-based tumour that's bigger than 3 or 4 millimetres will be spreading its cancer cells into the bloodstream. Now, that doesn't mean that all cancers are metastatic. It doesn't mean they're going to spread to other parts of the body, because only certain types of cancer cells, called stem-like cancer cells, have that ability to go somewhere else and settle and then grow within that area. Most cancer cells are what are called stromal cells, where they make up the body of the tumour, but they aren't the ones that can go and settle elsewhere. So the test looks at stem-like cells and can capture them even from small tumours, perhaps tumours smaller than a CT or MRI scan will pick up on. The lab measures markers and is able to tell the practitioner what chemotherapy will kill those cancer cells. The cancer cells are grown in the lab and are tested against a wide range of drugs as well. So they actually are able to tell which chemotherapy agents work. Now, most chemotherapy agents that are given to people are chosen on the basis of national and international studies. But when we have a drug that will work on, say, 60% of people, that means that there are 40% who will get that drug course because it's the best drug course we can offer, but it won't necessarily work. But if this, if these investigations come to the fore and become accepted, then the chances are we will be using what is currently, let's say, a lung cancer drug on a colon cancer, because in that individual we have that drug working, or drugs working for that tumour in that person. Now, individualised testing is coming to the fore in a different way. What we are now seeing top oncology hospitals doing is they know that drug A, B and C can be used for colon cancer, and they will take the colon cancer when it's been removed and take a biopsy of it, and they will test it against drugs A, B and C. So the process is starting, but the RGCC have reversed the process and said, send us your cancer and we'll tell you what drug to use. Not, here, we're going to use these drugs and work out.
It's not such a limited selection.
It's not so limited. However, this is pioneering stuff, and the tests are expensive. And what you get back, unfortunately, at the moment for the UK practice, for your UK patient, is a set of results that won't help the oncologist, because the oncologist is at the moment saying, we've no idea if these are accurate. And some go further and say it isn't. I've been to three different day seminars put out by the RGC as part of my training for the use of their tests. And I've sat there with oncologists in the audience who have been critical. But by the time we get to tea time, and you go and have a cup of tea with the oncologist, so when you asked a question, did you feel it was a suitable answer? my personal experience has been the one, okay, we'll see the point. We'll need to see it working. So RGCC is now working in 40. I should absolutely say here, I've got no direct connection with this.
Fair enough.
It's just there's nowhere else doing it. That's the problem at the moment. So we're now reaching a point where we can utilize different labs to work out how to prepare people for treatment, what may be going wrong in the way of investigating cause, toxic environment, poor detoxification capability, and now specifically chemotherapy testing. And I've left, having summarized to that bit, the most important part to last, which is the lab test also looks at natural therapies.
Right.
It can't do so in the same way by making the statement this is 82% successful against the cancer, so the death rate of the cancer cell works. But it can look for how the cancer cell leads to its own natural death. This term apoptosis is cell natural death. And all cells have it. The trouble with cancer cells is that they attempt to be immortal and they live a lot longer and multiply their faulty action much, much more before they die off. But certain natural compounds increase the rate of apoptosis. So whilst this is not a clear-cut chemotherapy, what it is telling us what natural compounds tell the cancer cell to die off quicker.
Okay, can I ask a question about that?
Please.
Just from your experience, I mean, we all know that there's a sort of hierarchy of evidence which, you know, starts off in the lab testing things and then gets put into animals and then into human beings, and things often don't translate.
Correct.
Between one and the other. What looks fantastic in the lab is a completely different story in human beings. So what's your experience of how the information you're given correlates to, you know, actual effect in your patients?
I'm not an oncologist.
Yeah.
I don't treat cancer per se. I treat individuals who have cancer.
Right.
I'm in no position at all to answer that from anything other than my personal experience.
Yeah.
And not being associated with labs, except as a prescriber, and not being associated with product sales, I feel that I can say this without any suggestion that there is a benefit to me to say, wow, this is a great drug, this is a great remedy, you know, you must all come in and take your Artemisia. So I can say this, I think, with a fair level of a lack of bias. I have always said that the likelihood of any integrated approach is to move an individual into their success category. Now, what I mean by that is that if somebody comes to see me and is told they have a 20% two-year survival, I ask the question, if humans are principally the same, although we are quite individual, and a cancer is principally the same, although it too has its nuances, and yet a treatment is successful in 80%, but not in 20 or the other way around, what is it that's making the difference? It's not the cancer. It's not the treatment. It's got to be the individual. Because we have evidence without doubt that people can have the most aggressive cancer, which then goes away. Okay. It is rare, but we know it happens, and it happens because the body overrides the problem. So I say to people, if I can move you from the 80% category into the 20% success category, it's going to be because I've helped you alter something about you that wasn't going to survive the cancer if you didn't make the change. So my experience is that the majority of people that come to see me, and I think I can comment on this for my colleagues as well, otherwise we wouldn't do it. When none of us are oncologists, very few of us have clinics that treat cancer. We are generalists. And none of us want to sit there dealing with unsuccessful therapy.
Yeah.
We can fill our days up with treatments that we know work and help people. And yet most of us are finding our cancer cases increasing. And we're very happy about it because what we see is more and more people falling into the success category. Now, you can't audit that, Because if somebody goes in for a treatment in conventional care with a 20% two-year survival, and they're there 2 years later, 5 years later, the conventional medicine will take its credit.
Mm.
But the fact that we would, if we were, and we will eventually, create that unity amongst the integrated practitioners in this country and start putting out our hundreds of cases a year that will amount to perhaps thousands of cases a year, and we can show, well, actually, you know, we would have expected 20% of our population, of our patients, to survive 2 years or 5 years, and look, we've got 40, or we've got 80%, then we can start to show this integrated approach has got evidence behind that which I'm telling you now from my own personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Right, so anyway, so I think you're saying that you set considerable store by this testing, and you think it's a good foundation.
Patients come to see me, and I sit down with them and talk about a swimming pool of opportunity, because you can dive in the deep end. And if you dive in the deep end, you can you can entertain the use of the more aggressive and invasive treatment. But you can also look at the test options. But if you are going to go through the RGCC, and you are going to go through the DNA testing, you are going to go through your hepatic detoxification process, you're going to be paying for it.
Yeah, it's an investment.
So tests vary, really, I suppose, from about £2,000 up to £3,500. But then vitamin C therapy is often twice that, you know, and if you go for the higher doses and the longer courses. So is it better to know that vitamin C worked in the lab, which, as you say, doesn't translate into the human, but if you've got that sort of money, you can do it. But then there's a shallow end, and the shallow end of the pool is people walk in and say, well, I don't have the funds. Like, okay. I say, well, look, you know, other people have, and I'm doing this test regularly, and you've got this sort of cancer. So my record suggests that this might be of benefit.
Right.
So let's entertain all the holistic stuff about how you got the problem, why you got the problem, what can we do to get rid of the underlying aspect, how do we build you up? And then here are some options. Off you go to your oncologist, have a chat. At the end of the day, it's your choice. But let's make sure that the oncologists aren't going to say, well, you can't do that because that will mess around with my conventional therapy. If they say that, well, we rethink. If they say, I think you're wasting your time, your money, your effort, don't do it, well, try and get something a little bit more substantial out of the conventional doctor, because that, if it's just his negativity or her lack of education in this area, then, you know, I think it's probably worthwhile taking those few extra vitamins, because the chances of it being a problem are slim. And if you're under the guidance of an integrated physician, you're very unlikely to go very long taking something that's not doing you good. And I don't think many of us, well, I certainly have got no experience of people following a naturopathic path who do worse. At best, we're being useless.
Right. Okay. Won't harm, might help.
That is my general belief, correctly provided and correctly prescribed. Because don't forget, without having to sound too crude, nature is a mother. And Mother Nature can be very, very harmful to us. So we need to be very wary and mustn't assume that chemicals bad, nature good. Far from it.
Right. Fair comment. So I know you're keen to say something about Dr. Heinrich Kremer's cell symbiosis therapy, which you set some store by. So
I do. I was introduced to this principle by Dr. Gillian Crowther, fantastic colleague of mine. Very, very knowledgeable in nutritional medicine. She's a PhD in nutrition. And I was also aware for quite some time of the importance of mitochondria in general health. But as a medical student, I was told a bit about what it did. Probably knew more from my A-level biology than I did at medical school. And I wasn't therefore surprised those 4 or 5 years ago when Gillian introduced me to the principles of Dr. Kremer in Germany and his cell symbiosis therapy, because most chronic disease has associated with it dysfunctional cells that don't particularly like oxygen, and in part that is because their mitochondria become dysfunctional. Now, mitochondria are tiny little parts in cells that take sugar and oxygen and turn it into energy. And we have these terms, aerobic, lots of air, and anaerobic, no air. And cancer cells are predominantly anaerobic. They function without the need for mitochondrial activity. It is well established that cancer cells have faulty mitochondria. I'm not quite sure, but it's, you know, I'm a frontline physician, not a research scientist, whether it would be fair to say that we know that a cancer cell becomes cancerous and then turns the mitochondria into dysfunction, or whether a cancer cell may actually stem from dysfunction of the mitochondria in the first place.
One of the big arguments around today.
There we go. Yeah. So this mitochondrial theory of cancer, as it's coined, leads me to accept that Cramer's principles, based on the Nobel Prize winning Otto Warburg, that if you can correct mitochondrial dysfunction, you can make a big difference to chronic disease. And cancer, of course, is a chronic disease. So, introduced to it, the evidence appears quite strong that given the right levels of particular botanicals, herbal extracts, turmeric, resveratrol, salvestrol, I mentioned them earlier, bringing into play polyphenols from plants, which are potent antioxidants but have many other functions, combining that with particular amino acids that seem to either enhance the immune system function or interfere with cancer cell activity, plus building up the bowel flora, an extremely important aspect of both immunity and absorption of nutrients. And then slight tailoring around the individual. So it's not one treatment fits all. Mm. There is a core that we then adjust as we get more experienced into these therapies. And as this treatment can also be given intravenously, we can give quite high doses at times when it won't interfere with chemotherapy or perhaps radiotherapy. We can use both oral and IV therapy leading up to surgery, leading up to chemo and radiotherapy. And we can use it afterwards when people aren't feeling so well. We're trying to build them back up again. And the potential, I think, is there. Again, are we going to get the rapid influx or outflux of information and research papers on what effectively, in comparison to drug treatment, is a fraction of profit in things that are not patentable? So whilst the cell symbiosis therapy has, you know, produces its own compounds and making it easier, you don't have to take 40 different things, they're all encapsulated in different ways, you can go down a therapeutic program that may well make a profound difference, is so unlikely to interfere with a conventional therapy and may add the pre as well as the post benefits, seems to me a no-brainer. And whilst I think we've all been doing this in integrated medicine for a long time,
in lots of different ways, this is very focused.
This now seems focused.
Yeah.
And then we have Sarah Myhill's mitochondrial work, if you've come across the papers that she's done, which again, adamantly and categorically, I think, point out how chronic fatigue is so constantly associated with mitochondrial dysfunction. Not that chronic fatigue and cancer have a great relationship, but it is an indication of how if you have a dysfunctional cell, the cell goes wrong. So if you've got a cell that has gone wrong and become cancerous and it has a mitochondrial dysfunction, you're going to have a much bigger problem. Correct the mitochondrial dysfunction, who knows what benefits you might get. Mm. So yes, I'm very excited about that.
Mm. Okay, well look, we're out of time. There's a lot more we could talk about. I can see that. Have to be part two, I think.
Oh, it'd be an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, so thanks very much indeed, Rajendra. And I look forward to talking again in another show.
Thank you.
As always, links to material covered in my interview with Dr. Sharma are on the Yes to Life website. So go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife.org.uk. Click the link to Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. Next week, I'm excited to say, I'm beginning the first of a series of shows devoted to the new book, The Cancer Revolution, which is due to be published in April and which is the result of the collaboration of 38 experts from around the world. The Cancer Revolution is being sold entirely in aid of Yes to Life, and for the first show, I shall be talking to the book's author, Patricia Peat of Cancer Options. Do make a point of listening. Goodbye.